February 1st, 2008. Co-chairs of the committee, Senator Peter Courtney and Representative Diane Rosenbaum.
State Hospital Patient Care to order. I refer to it as the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Orange State Hospital Patient Care. We're here in the basement of Building 40, Orange State Hospital, on about 9/8/2008. I wanted the first meeting of the Oversight Committee to be on the State Hospital grounds. Specifically, I did not want it to be in the administration building. I wanted it to be where the patients were, and that's where we're at, in one of the patient areas in the basement of Building 40. I must say, I understand that when we follow our meeting, where's Rick? Where's my committee? Rick, you want to describe up front about the tours that will take place following our meeting? Could you describe that, please?
Thank you, Chair Courtney. For members and only members who are interested in touring the state hospital wards, they are prepared to do that. This will only be, because of the situation, only available to a small group of members who may want to go up there and tour. So just let me know before the meeting, because we have them
Okay. I'm Peter Courtney, State Senator, District 11, which includes portions of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. I'm going to co-chair this. To my right, to your left.
I'm going to co-chair this.
Tell him, Jackie.
To my right.
A good senator from Salem, Monmouth, Independence, and Turner.
Senator Jackie Winters.
Senator Jackie
Winters.
And I am State Representative Diane Rosenbaum, Speaker Pro Tem of the Oregon House, and very pleased to be serving as co-chair of this committee with the Senate President.
I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei from Milwaukee and Southeast Heartlands, and I appreciate the Senator and the Speaker Pro Tem allowing me to be on this committee.
Thank you. I'm State Representative Bob Jensen from Hamilton, and we are appreciative of being assigned to this committee. I look forward to coming up with some meaningful information for our stockbridge on in the future.
They were Representative Vicki Berger from the Salem area, the West Salem, Monmouth, Independence.
We will be staffed by Rick Rogovian, and do we have a sufficient number here for the rules to be adopted, committee administrator?
Mr. Chair, we have enough. The House could, and then we can get a third member from the Senate and do likewise.
Well, wait to see if we do that, so we can dispose of that when we get up for one. All right, I'm just going to jump right into it. I'm going to ask our first witness to come up, identify herself, and I'll just ask her some questions. So, Vicki Logan, who is the Senior Assistant Attorney General for the State of Oregon. Counsel Logan.
Vicki Logan, who is the...
It's my understanding that, officially, because it's here, that on January 9th of this year, a report was filed with the Governor's Office from the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, and the filing was a result of an investigation that they did at the Oregon State Hospital November 13th, November 14th, November 15th, 16th, 2006.
That's correct.
Right. That report contained background, findings, recommendations, and conclusions over some 48 pages regarding the conditions at the Oregon State Hospital. And it's my also understanding that you are the official party representing the Oregon Attorney General's Office and therefore our attorney in these matters. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
All right. Would you identify yourself officially and formally, even though I've done so, and present to us your comments and conclusions regarding that report?
Thank you. Chair Courtney, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Vicki Logan. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. I am in the General Counsel Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I have been assigned to represent the Department of Human Services since 1993, and 3 years ago, I had added to my specific assignments within DHS, the Addictions and Mental Health Division at DHS, and in that includes the Oregon State Hospital. As the attorney for the Oregon State Hospital and DHS, I am the state's lead attorney in dealing with the U.S. DOJ on its investigation of the Oregon State Hospital. I need to tell you, as an Oregon AG, my statutory role is simply to provide legal advice and analysis. I don't make policy choices. I certainly know the policy choices and well-versed in the policies of the state hospital, DHS, and I can speak to the ramifications of policy choices, but if you had a particular question about a policy choice that wasn't about the legal ramification or something, it would probably be appropriate for me to defer that till later. I know that Dr. Goldberg, Assistant Director Bob Nickel, and Interim Superintendent Maynard Hammer here will be speaking later this morning. So just so you know, my presentation is really going to be the facts, the information. I'm not here to sway policy. That's not my job. So.
I also understand, Counsel, that you'd like to be allowed at least some 30 minutes to make your presentation, at which time then we would have questions. Is that right, Counsel?
Yeah, I think it would be easy. I think it would be easier because I'm came here today to sort of view myself as your attorney because I'm the state's attorney, and I want to give you the information so you have the context when we go through the report for where we've been, where we're at, where we need to go, at least just from the USDOJ's perspective. I should tell you, I did talk to the USDOJ. I've probably spoken with them at least four times this week already. I speak with them regularly. I am the person who's doing the communicating with the USDOJ. So I want to make sure you folks know what we've been doing, and I think it would be useful for you. I hope it would be useful to you. Speaking of that dialogue with the USDOJ, as you can imagine, it's somewhat delicate because we maybe end up in litigation. Having said that, I am not here today to dispute anything in the report, but as I'm not, as the lead attorney for the USDOJ, it would be helpful to the state of Oregon if I come right out and concede anything. Now, I'm not going to be able to say to you, this is constitutionally inadequate care. That would be inappropriate for me to do. This doesn't mean that I'm not going to have a frank discussion and go over it with you directly. The governor informed the USDOJ in June of 2006 when they sent their letter that the state of Oregon would cooperate fully with the investigation, and we have done so. The governor continues to seek a collaborative resolution to the concerns raised in the USDOJ report. USDOJ in the report has praised Oregon's cooperation to date, and in fact, we truly, and this is straight, we are working quite well with the USDOJ. Doesn't mean the problems aren't really serious, but we're working well with them, and that is one of the best strategies we can have, is to work together, because everyone's objective, the USDOJ and everyone involved with us in Oregon, the legislative branch, executive branch, all want to have much better outcomes for patients at the state hospital. If we obtain that goal, if we focus on it and actually take some action, there won't be litigation. The states that have had litigation with USDOJ are the states that failed to act, that failed to actually do something. So the fact that you are, Senator Courtney, that you have put together this committee is fabulous. It's a really good sign to the USDOJ and to Oregon that people are going to roll up their sleeves and get some work done. Having said all of that, we have to recognize that there is a possibility of litigation. And so please don't take it as me trying to be difficult. If you ask us a specific question and I don't give you the specific answer you want, since this is a public forum, I'm not going to be able to always say, yes, we agree with that, or no, we don't. But I think if we just go through the report and talk about it, there won't be a need to be put in that position.
Counsel, just Representative Conklin, if you want to introduce yourself, please, we're welcome. Glad to see you.
Good morning. Bruce Hanna, House District 7, State Representative from Roseburg area, and Queens North.
Thank you. Sorry, Counsel, I wanted to acknowledge. Thank you. please proceed, Councilwoman.
Thank you, Chair. All right, so I understand that you need the following information from me. You want me to explain how the CRIP investigation started, what we did leading up to the report, and what the next steps are responding to the report, and also to do an overview of the USCD DOJ's finding letter that was received on January 9th. In order to put that all that information in context, and we'll be discussing that, I want to briefly describe for you CRIPA itself, the law that the US DOJ is operating under, and the experience the other states have had with CRIPA investigations like this. So you have some context. That won't take very long, but I think it might be useful. CRIPA is the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act. It authorizes the US DOJ to conduct investigations and litigation relating to conditions of confinement in state or locally operated institutions. Okay? It doesn't cover private facilities. It was enacted in 1980, and since then, U.S. DOJ has investigated more than 430 facilities in 39 states, District of Columbia, and Virgin Islands, etc. Their work, the U.S. DOJ's CRIPA work, is in five areas. They go into jails and prisons. A lot of their reports about jails and prisons. They do juvenile correctional facilities. They investigate state or locally run mental health facilities and state or locally run developmental disability and mental rehabilitation facilities and state-run nursing homes. So obviously this is in the mental health facilities category. But so when I say there are 430 facilities they've gone into, they haven't been 430 state hospitals. So what they do under the statute, what they have to prove under the statute if they were to pursue litigation, is whether there is a pattern or practice of a violation of the resident's federal rights. So they have to demonstrate a pattern or practice of a violation of a resident of the resident's federal rights. They don't represent individuals. They actually just, it's almost like a class action suit, the way they pursue these things. It might be useful to you to know, you're all really busy, but there is a US DOJ website that contains a lot of information about CRIPA, and in fact it has the most recent findings letters, and I think it might be useful for you to see how our letter so it compares to other letters. If you want that website, do you want me to give it to you now, or do you want me to, okay. It's www.usdoj.gov/CRT/split/CRIPA, which is CRIPA.htm. That'll get you right into their findings letters and information about them. So, speaking of their findings letters, I'm very fortunate as an AG in Oregon because DHS has assisted me with becoming a member of an organization. The acronym is NASBID, and it means the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, which basically are all the people in the country who do what Bob Nichols, Assistant Director Bob Nichols, does. They have a legal division, which there are 50 AGs in the country who do what I do. They represent the state hospitals around the country. And I have had the good fortune to attend four of those meetings. I'm actually now the vice president of that organization. And I've had a fabulous opportunity to consult with numerous AGs who have been through CRIPA investigations, worked with USDOJ, in fact, worked with the particular lead attorney that I've been dealing with USDOJ. So I can speak with confidence about the experience of other states, because I speak with them regularly. We communicate by email and by phone. In particular, I have talked quite a bit with my counterparts in Hawaii, Mississippi, Washington State, Virginia, North Carolina, Connecticut, Texas, and Vermont. And those states have had a variety of experiences. Some of them, for Hawaii, for example, had a 16-year case litigation. I'll talk about that again in a minute. That was very litigious, very difficult, very expensive in the state of Hawaii. North Carolina, on the other hand, worked out an agreement, a settlement agreement, and never did get into court. So there's just a wide variety of experiences other states have had.
Mr. President, are you going to allow questions during the session? Would you rather we held them?
I would rather you hold them at this time.
I am not aware, and neither are my counterparts in the other states, of any state that has ever been investigated by the U.S. DOJ that has not received a letter with multiple findings or recommendations. That's what the U.S. DOJ does. It doesn't just go into a state and sort of say, oh, things are fine, and leave. I mean, by the time it comes into the state, it's probably been watching the state for quite a while. We can only speculate why they come into a state, because as a policy matter, the U.S. DOJ will not tell us or anybody why they chose to investigate a particular state. But the pattern seems to be that they've received complaints, they've been watching, they certainly read the media. In Georgia last year, a year ago, the Atlanta Journal did it. Major series about the state mental health system there. 3 months later, the U.S. DOJ was there. And in fact, they spent a lot of last year, and they're still very busy in Georgia. The U.S. DOJ findings letter range from about 40 pages in length to about 100 pages in length. That's not to say that if it's a shorter letter, it's not as serious. In fact, California, the shortest letter I could find was one of the state hospitals in California. California's system was in such dire straits that they ended, U.S. DOJ sued them, and the courts were so concerned they put that entire system into receivership. I mean, it's just been totally taken over by the courts. And that was a short letter. So you can't judge from the page numbers whether it's serious. But I'm just saying that they do range. Oregon's finding letter, which is quite serious, is in some ways similar and remarkably similar to some other states' finding letters. My point of all this is what the U.S. DOJ does. It comes in because it has identified a state has some serious issues going on. It reports on those those issues, and it requires, it really holds people to the fire. It really requires the states to address the problems. If the states don't address the problems themselves, they will be forced to, through court, a court having it. Having to make them do it. So if they sue, one of the potential effects is that a court monitor would be appointed by a court, and the court monitor in the court would deem what is necessary. And that's what happened in Hawaii. The findings letter was issued in 1991 in Hawaii about one state hospital. And Hawaii chose to take a non-cooperative approach to be defensive and not to try to change things initially. And that case was ultimately completed last year. 16-year litigation. It cost the state tens of millions of dollars, and
it cost the state tens of
ironically, it started out with a report on one state hospital, and by the time the whole case was over, the court had completely revised the entire mental health system in Hawaii, so it spread to the entire state. And you know, that's not to say that that wasn't necessary or anything like that. It's just to say that the philosophy U.S. DOJ has, that the governor's office, executive branches, and the fact that you're here demonstrate that the legislature has, is it's better for Oregon to fix itself. The changes will be embraced more, and will be more Oregon-centric. Rather, and that we work collaboratively with the USJ to make sure we're doing what they think we need to do. But if an entity, any entity, or any person chooses to fix something else, it is more long-lasting and more effective. So doing that is where it's at. We are somewhat different from other states. I've been describing some of the similarities because we have been so cooperative with the USDOJ. And I can say that with confidence because I do speak with the USDOJ regularly, and they know I'm saying that today, and they said I could. So we are more cooperative than other states. And another way that we are different from other states is that it was apparent to them when they came that we wanted to roll up our sleeves, that we were acknowledging that we have a lot of issues. And so they did an exit interview when they left and gave us some ideas of where we needed to work. And the state hospital did, and the agency did roll up their sleeves and start to work and did develop a continuous improvement plan, and they've been trying to make changes since November 2006, and not waiting like most states do for the report to come out from the USDOJ. Not to say that that plan doesn't need to be substantially revised, updated, and really worked on, but the point is we haven't been waiting to change ourselves. And that hasn't been lost on the USDOJ. As I said, now to talk about sort of process, how we got here. The USDOJ wrote to the governor in June 2006. The governor, as I said, reported back that Oregon would be cooperative. I was assigned to be the lead attorney. I started speaking regularly with the USDOJ, and they asked for a lot of materials before they came out in November. We provided them everything they requested. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of, probably thousands of documents before they came out, while they were here, and after they left. In fact, just to give you a sense of how many documents we're talking about, the state hospital had to put certain staff in, I don't know if they rented extra copy machines or if they moved them all together, and they had, I think it was this space here, set up with copy machines, so they were constantly copying all these patient records and things that the and policies that the experts for the USDOJ wanted to see. So we were very cooperative and provided that information. And then one of the things we did before they came out is we hired our own experts. Now they are Dr. Jeffrey Geller and Dr. Chris McLaughlin. Both of these experts have worked for the USDOJ on numerous occasions in their investigations of other states. They are very, very highly regarded national experts. The USDOJ really likes our experts, Dr. McLaughlin and Dr. Geller. And in fact, Dr. McLaughlin was the court monitor in Hawaii. So these are people who really know what they're doing. And they were very instrumental and very involved with the development of the continuous improvement plan that I mentioned earlier. They've been here several times, and they've been training, focusing way more recently a lot of their time and energy at the state hospital on treatment planning. And the two of them combined bring in a lot of expertise because of all of the state hospitals and work they've done around the country. So when the USDOJ visited Oregon in November, it brought five experts of its own. It brought a psychiatric services expert, a psychologist, a skills facilities expert, and a quality assurance expert. So they brought five experts. All these five experts wanted to tour the hospital for the 5 days they were here. So we gave them a tour guide. Each of their experts had an attorney from the USDOJ with them. So we had our attorneys there, and we had these little groups of people who went around. And what we did in order to prepare the hospital, because as you can imagine, this was a lot of people walking through the hospital during that week, we provided to the staff at the hospital frequently asked questions and tips for how to handle this week, this tour. And if you're interested, I did bring copies of that so you can see what we told the staff about it. And you'll see that we stressed that they're the guests of the hospital would be very cooperative. But it might be useful for you to know what we told. So I see the staff is seeking that out for you. So on the last day of the week-long visit, they did do an exit interview. They didn't provide us anything in writing at that time. And as I said earlier, we were fortunate that they did give us an exit interview. They told us that it was unusual that they would do that, but they could see that we wanted to get to work. Then in 2000, they left in November 2006, and after that, in 2007, we had relatively little, practically no communications with the USDOJ. I felt the best to just let them contact us, and because they've been really busy in some other states, as I said, Georgia and some other states, and they got hold of me right before they sent out the letter in the beginning of January, and that's when I heard from them again. So that's been the process, but that's not to say that during the year that we didn't hear from them that we weren't busy. Since they left, as I said, the state hospital started developed. By April it was done, the continuous improvement plan, and it has, the continuous improvement plan itself, I can't remember how many pages it is, but it's almost 50 pages, or maybe 40 pages, and it has an action plan associated with it, it has time frames and all of that. There was a lot of work that went into that, and a fair amount of things within the current budget, within the current statutes that the state hospital has been able to work with. Some of those things have been accomplished already. Not insignificant thing that also happened in 2007 is that the legislative assembly authorized the state hospital replacement project, which, as you can imagine, as you know, is huge. Hugely huge. It has not been lost on the USDOJ. The legislative assembly also approved an additional 17 registered nurse positions. Drs. Geller and McLaughlin continued to come in 2007 and work with the staff here on training and changes that they viewed and to help the hospital embrace some changes. And, of course, DHS is preparing a budget to try to get more positions during the 2009-11 biennium. The other thing that was very significant in terms of things that have changed since 2006 at the hospital is that the agency has an agreement now with OHSU, and they've increased the number of psychiatrists working at the hospital. It's resulted in the appointment of a chief psychiatrist and 6 additional psychiatrists. It's rather complicated how the numbers work, but it's suffice to say that if a doctor has 40 patients, rather than the 15 that is generally viewed as a healthy practice for an institution like this, it's not a good thing for the patient. So having more doctors is pretty significant. And in the meantime, Oregon State Hospital was visited by the Joint Commission, and continues to be accredited by the Joint Commission. Would it be helpful for me to tell you what the Joint Commission is? Yes. Okay. What the Joint Commission is, I decided I didn't want to characterize them, so I'm reading from their website. It's an entity that evaluates and accredits more than 15,000 healthcare organizations and programs in the U.S. It's an independent, not-for-profit organization. It's the nation's predominant standard-setting and accrediting body in healthcare. They go on like that, and then they say, the Joint Commission's accreditation is recognized nationwide as a symbol of quality that reflects the organization's commitment to meeting certain performance standards. To earn and maintain the Joint Commission's seal of approval, an organization must undergo an on-site survey by a Joint Committee Commission survey team at least every 3 years. So, the state hospital is accredited by the Joint Commission. Now, obviously, the Joint Commission looks at different things, but some of the same things that USDOJ. USDOJ is about civil rights. The Joint Commission is a hospital. Review entity. So they are different standards, they are different things, but I mention that because that has been part of what's been happening over the last year. So that gives you an overview, I hope, of what's happened up until now. Now that we have the USDOJ report, we have to continue to demonstrate that we're actually wanting to make change. That's the goal, because that's the right thing to do, and that's because that's what patients need. But as the lawyer for the state of Oregon on this, it's a good goal also, because I'm not trying to say that litigation should drive what you guys do and decisions you make, but it's the lens I look through. I look through the lens of litigation, and if the executive branch, the legislative branch, roll up their sleeves and get some work done.
The executive branch,
I can get what I want to accomplish, which is to avoid litigation. So, primary goal is obviously always patience. But fortunately, if that is kept as the goal and that's actually fixed and changes happen, I'm fairly confident we can avoid litigation. And working cooperatively with the U.S. DOJ is key to that. I mentioned earlier that North Carolina had a settlement agreement rather than litigation. Another state, Vermont, has a settlement agreement rather than litigation. Those states have worked very cooperatively with the U.S. DOJ. I might add that those states also had Dr. Geller as their expert. So that wasn't an accident that we chose Dr. Geller and McLaughlin. It was a very thought-out choice. But frankly, it's going to take a lot more resources, probably some statutory changes to address the issues, because they're very serious issues in the report. And so if we just talk about it and write about it, we will get sued. I'm talking to you straight because I'm your attorney. So there have to be changes made. And I want to stress that it has not escaped the USDOJ's notice that the legislature in Oregon, like Oregon's executive branch, is taking these issues very seriously. It's really good. It's also very unusual. It's highly unusual that Oregon legislature would get out front like this. From a litigation perspective, I mean, I know that's not where you're coming from, but where I'm coming from, that really helps my discussion with the U.S. DOJ. When I'm talking to a lead attorney at U.S. DOJ, I talked to him several times this week, they're glad you guys are having this hearing, you have this committee, and then you're going to get to work. So, that helped their goals as well as our goals. So with that perspective and context, I'd like to turn, I believe you would like me to talk about the U.S. DOJ report itself. I'm fairly confident we can avoid litigation. And working cooperatively with the U.S. DOJ is key to that. I mentioned earlier that North Carolina had a settlement agreement rather than litigation. Another state, Vermont, has a settlement agreement rather than litigation. Those states have worked very cooperatively with the U.S. DOJ. I might add that those states also had Dr. Geller as their expert. That wasn't an accident that we chose Dr. Geller and McLaughlin. It was a very thought-out choice. But frankly, it's going to take a lot more resources, probably some statutory changes to address the issues, because they're very serious issues in the report. And so if we just talk about it and write about it, we will get sued. I'm talking to you straight because I'm your attorney. So there have to be changes made. And I want to stress that it has not escaped the U.S. DOJ's notice that the legislature in Oregon, like Oregon's executive branch, is taking these issues very seriously. It's really good. It's also very unusual. It's highly unusual that Oregon legislature would get out front like this. From a litigation perspective, I mean, I know that's not where you're coming from, but where I'm coming from, that really helps my discussions with the U.S. DOJ. When I'm talking to the lead attorney at U.S. DOJ, I talked to him several times this week, they're glad you guys are having this hearing, you have this committee, and then you're going to get to work. So, that helps their goals as well as our goals. Perspective and context, I'd like to turn, I believe you would like me to talk about the U.S. DOJ report itself. Because I'm a lawyer, and I hate it when people paraphrase things, my belief is they always just water them down or make them worse or whatever. I'm just going to go, if you have the report in front of you, I'm just going to go page by page through the report. I'm not going to read the report to you, no, but I just want you to be able to follow it.
There's only one attorney up here, just so you know. In terms of, you say, because you're an attorney, that's fine, but you and in terms of how you describe these things, perhaps, I don't think I use legalese language. I didn't know that since you were saying that, Council.
Chair Courtney, I'm not going to use legalese language, but I'd like to use the language that the court uses itself.
And the reason I'm saying is I got members on both sides, and Diane just started asking questions, so I don't have to control the truth.
I'm dying not to go through the report.
We need something on the record.
Okay.
Council, this is one of the, there's something on the record, but I agree, you don't have to do 48 pages of reading or anything like that.
I would not want to do, what I was going to say is that, I would not want to do. You might, I was going to say, imagine, it's a little awkward for me to be out here telling you about the report from someone who may be my opposing counsel sometime. So I can do that, and I'm happy to do that, but I'm not here to dispute the report, especially not in this forum, but
I'm not here to dispute.
I think the better thing is just to know what it says and to recognize that it's serious. So the first thing the report does is that it explains a lot of things that we've already talked about. It gives background about the state hospital. I don't know how many of you have much experience, but the actual background section on page 2 of the report is actually very useful, I think, to give context to your work and the hospital's work. They visited two campuses. There are two campuses for the state hospital. There's this campus in Salem, and then there's a Portland campus. The Portland campus is only 54 beds. This facility has 627 beds. The state hospital, on page 3 report, they describe this, but this is crucial in your work to understand that people come into the hospital two ways. They come in through the criminal courts, and then come in through the civil courts. In the criminal court, the forensic, we call it the forensic psychiatric services here at the hospital, that is the bulk of the patients at the state hospital. So they give the numbers here, there's 434 beds for the forensic patients at the state hospital. There are 393 in Salem and 54 in Portland. There's 237 beds for the civil patients. So when we say forensic patients, we're talking about those people, basically three categories, who have been committed to the hospital through the criminal courts because they've been found incompetent to stand trial, not guilty by reason of insanity, and inmates who are transferred from the correctional system to here, and individuals who are here to be evaluated. The criminal courts want them evaluated to see if they have the ability to aid the system in our defense. The civil patients come through here because of civil commitment, and there also are geriatric patients. They have two units for geriatric patients at the state hospital, and they have a unit with patients who have severe brain damage. That's sort of the background that they give. That might be useful for you to be aware of. I'm sure you're going to learn and see a lot more about the state hospital as time goes on. The actual findings begin on page 5, and they summarize them on page 5, and then they break down. One thing would be useful to you as you look through the report is look at the headings. The headings spell it out pretty nicely. Every paragraph of this report is powerful.
They're very
important. And so if I'm skipping through things, it doesn't mean I don't think the other things are important. But what they talk about is that the Odyssey Hospital, here are their primary findings. Fails to ensure reasonable safety of its patients. Fails to provide adequate mental health treatment. Engages in the inappropriate use of seclusion and restraints. Fails to provide adequate nursing care. And fails to provide adequate discharge planning. And then it gives a lot of findings to explain how they came to those determinations. One of the critical things on page 6, but for the sense of the whole report and what's happening at the hospital, the USDOJ findings about, is the high levels of incidents at this hospital. There were 392 patient against patient assaults between January and December 2005. Also, many incidents of self-harm. There's also a pattern of falls. is also a pattern of power. The report talks about incident reporting. The report and quality management, legislators, there's no doubt in my mind that you understand how important.
There's no doubt in my mind that
you're able to track and report and be able to have a sense of what's happening and what they have found in on page 8 is the lack of clarity and conformity in order to hospitals' incident reporting system virtually ensures that adverse events will not be reported or characterized We then go on to talk about how when things are reported,
we then go on to
how the actual investigations are inadequate. And what they say about that in some is that on page 9, by failing to require investigations, establish procedures for conducting investigations and follow up on the investigations conducted, Ferguson Hospital is missing both the opportunity to identify the underlying causes of incidents and the chance to correct deficiencies that might prevent similar incidents from occurring in the future. Then again, they talk about the incident tracking and trending.
Then again, they talk about the
inadequate quality management. One particular, I'll highlight one point about that. One page 10, they write, throughout this letter, we enumerate various failures at Ferguson Hospital to provide adequate care and treatment for its patients. With few exceptions, Ferguson Hospital has failed to identify these problems independently or formulated to implement remedies to address them. Consequently, actual and potential sources of harm to Ferguson Hospital's patients are going unaddressed. Page 11, they talk about something that I'm not going to spend time on today because we all know a lot about it already, and that is the failure to provide a safe living environment. They say that the physical plant, Salem campus, is in a state of severe deterioration and serious dilapidation. Page 12, they begin talking and writing and showing us about the failure to provide adequate mental health care. Obviously, this is a very significant, very, very significant area. If you would like me, would you like me to tell you all the things they say about that, or is that sufficient?
I need to tell you
what need to say.
I think you should say some of the others.
Okay, then what I would like to, what they talk about in the mental health care is that the Oregon State Hospital simply does not conduct initial assessments. In instances that they are performed, they often do not identify or prioritize specific mental health problems and needs. Obviously, when you're talking about a mental health hospital, is crucial. There are things I could say to dispute that finding. But that would be wrong because goes right to the heart of what this hospital is about. Probably goes right to the heart of the fact that they have doctors who have 45 patients. Our experts are telling us that the treatment planning and the diagnoses and all of that, needs serious work, and the hospital recognizes that it needs serious work, and that's the area they're probably prioritizing besides the building of a new hospital. On page 14, inadequate behavioral management services. One of the threads of all of these findings is somewhat summed up in the ideas too. It's on the bottom of page 14. Behavioral management plans at Ferguson Hospital are inadequate and not well integrated with overall treatment. A lot of what the USCJ is writing here about, is that things throughout the state hospital and actually in Oregon's mental health system in general are not sufficiently integrated. You've got the system before people get into the hospital. And once people get into the hospital, they go into their separate units and separate wards. And then they get out and they have one separate thing. And it's not a continuum of care. It's really one of the thrusts of these findings. So when you talk about behavioral management plans and inadequate and not well integrated, opioid and the overall treatment, that's a thread throughout all of the findings. It's a crucial thread. If I don't spend much time on a section, it doesn't mean that it's not the most important section. It doesn't mean that it's just that my time is almost up and it's a 48-page report.
My time is almost up.
And I do want to leave time for you to be able to ask questions. On page 17, they talk about the inadequate medication management and monitoring practices at the state hospital. Very serious allegations, statements here. Medication practices at the Oregon State Hospital substantially depart from the generally accepted professional standards.
Could you go back?
Yes.
Because you skipped to page 15.
Yes.
Because you skipped to page 15.
Yeah, well, thank you. Co-chairs, Vice Chair Winters.
Co-chair.
I appreciate that. That is page 15 of this report.
I appreciate that.
Just skip that page. Very important and critical to the findings. They found numerous cases where patients exhibited self-injurious behavior or aggressive behavior towards others for extended periods due to ineffective treatment plans. Contrary to generally accepted professional standards, staff effort is focused primarily on controlling dangerous patients rather than treating them and changing their behavior.
Thank you.
That is, in fact, where it's at.
We're trying to move too quickly because
Drs. Geller and Dr. McLaughlin, when they first came in September of 2006, immediately identified this issue. State Hospital has interim superintendent Nathan Hammer talked about this more, but they have made this particular issue of treatment planning the priority. It's not my role here to talk about the reasons for that.
It goes
to the heart of everything at the state hospital.
Because it is a hospital.
It's about treatment.
Because it is a hospital.
And it's having patients hurting themselves and hurting others because they're not receiving adequate treatment. It is a sad comment on the state hospital. And I'm not going to dispute that. On page 17, they also made a finding of inadequate medication management and monitoring. Oregon State Hospital's inappropriate pharmacological practices have led to the inappropriate use of PRN as needed medication. There's also an issue our own experts identified and that the state hospital has been trying to actively address. It's a very serious finding that because Oregon State Hospital psychiatrists really analyze the use of PRN medications and patients with reactions to them, they cannot refine patients' diagnosis and adjust routinely administered medications. Without such monitoring, patients are at risk of being overly or improperly medicated. This practice constitutes this chemical restraint, which violates federal regulations and which violates substantially departs from generally accepted professional standards. It's so hard to be the bearer of bad news, but it just gets to be worse and worse. And when we talk about inappropriate use of seclusion restraints, this is an issue. You'll find if you look at the findings letters for the other states, this topic of seclusion restraints
is that every filing letter I looked at, it's a big problem in the United States of America, and it's a big problem here in this hospital. So much I could say about seclusion and restraints, but I think I'll leave that for questions for you. But to say that two sentences in here that say quite a bit. The state hospital's policy vis-a-vis seclusion and restraints is in stark contrast to generally accepted professional standards. In practice, planned seclusion and restraint often is the only component of the patient's treatment plan. And then in their heading on page 22,
and then
they're defining the use of seclusion and restraint as informal and alternatives to treatment and as punishment. Add that another concern about seclusion and restraint at the Augustine Hospital is the widespread use of ad hoc restrictive measures such as suicide suits, safety status, east end restriction, the 10-foot rule, and security holds. These unconventional measures are not defined or described in OSH policy, rather they appear to be improvised responses to patient behavior that over time have been adopted throughout the facility. They also, on page 24, failure to assess patients in seclusion and restraint. Also on page 24, wrote a great deal about inadequate nursing care. This sentence here on the bottom of page 24 and perhaps 24 sums it all up. Orbiter Hospital is suffering from a chronic nursing shortage, which has caused a number of serious deficiencies in the nursing services provided to patients. Specifically, nursing staff fail to provide basic care such as monitoring vital signs and responding in a timely manner to changes in patients' medical status. Fail to actively participate in the treatment team process by providing feedback on patients' responses to medication and behavioral interventions, fail to properly document and monitor the administration of medications, and fail to implement adequate infection control procedures. These deficiencies expose the Oregon State Hospital patients to harm and a significant risk of harm. For two full pages on pages 25 and 26. And if you look at all the different findings, it's interesting because they're not, usually they don't spend two full pages on a topic, so that gives you some indication of how important the USDOJ finds this topic. Many of the shortcomings in nursing care are exacerbated by the lack of adequate staffing, support, training, and supervision. The chronic shortage of nursing staff at the Augustine Hospital has received press coverage. In efforts to triage its staffing issues, Augustine Hospital uses a significant amount of overtime. Indeed, during the first 6 months of 2006, overtime hours at the facility amounted to approximately 41 full-time equivalent positions. For instance, when completing seclusion and restraint review forms, staff repeatedly identify insufficient staffing as a serious concern. Staff indicate that they feel unsafe during emergency seclusion and restraint procedures, and in a number of cases, staff were injured because there were not enough staff to ensure the safety of those present. In short, Orbiter Hospital's staffing shortages fall dangerously below the minimum levels required to provide basic levels of nursing services and care. Unless and until the Orbiter Hospital hires, trains, and supervises a sufficient number of nursing staff, patients will continue to receive inadequate care. And remember, I talk to the USDOJ a lot. Nursing staff often fail to provide even the most basic care, opting instead for a reactive approach in which patients' medical needs are addressed only after problems develop. failure to provide feedback to treatment teams, the culture and the structure at Odessa Hospital do not facilitate communication between treatment team members. This gets back into that continuum that I was talking about earlier. Medication administration. We identified many instances in which staff documented that medication had been given when in fact the patient had never received it. Infection control. Oregon City Hospital's plan for infection control is inadequate and places patients and staff at substantial risk of exposure to dangerous diseases. Inadequate discharge planning and placement in the most integrated setting. This is on page 31 if you're following with me. The discharge planning process at Odessa Hospital falls significantly short of the standards of care. Treatment teams typically do not consider or integrate criteria for discharge into treatment planning. Consequently, many patients whose psychiatric conditions are largely under control remain hospitalized because of poor daily living skills, aggressive conduct, incontinence, inadequate dietary management, failure to take medication, and or other behaviors that prevent discharge and community reintegration.
Page 29, please.
Okay.
Can you read the bottom last sentence of the other infectious control? You can bottom the last sentence.
Yes. Indeed, of the 28 patient deaths that occurred between January 2005 and August 2006, 15 were from pneumonia and infection related conditions.
Can you read the top of the first sentence, page 30, please?
Neither Oregon State Hospital staff nor its patient comply with generally accepted standards for hand washing. Indeed, documents we reviewed reference nursing staff who administered medication and engaged in other patient care activities without washing their hands. Other documents noted problems with mice in patients' rooms, norovirus outbreaks, scabies outbreaks, and failure of staff to clean up messes in seclusion rooms. UCOJ also in talking about the integrated discharge planning process. Page 32, the UCOJ found that although we certainly do not advocate the release of dangerous patients persons in the community, we find that Oregon State Hospital often does not take appropriate steps to address the aggressive conduct that keeps many of its patients institutionalized. The failure to provide adequate individualized treatment and discharge planning for these and other patients deviates from generally accepted professional standards and contributes to extended hospitalization, unsuccessful community placements, and a high likelihood of readmission. Patients are harmed or exposed to the risk of harm by the effects of prolonged institutionalization and by being denied a reasonable opportunity to live successfully in the most integrated, appropriate setting. Page 33. Another difficulty with Oregon State Hospital's discharge planning is that the facility does not provide the follow-up supports and services that are essential for successful transitions to the community. The final problem with discharge planning at the Oregon State Hospital grows out of the contracting arrangement between the state and the privately owned and operated community providers. At present, these providers are allowed to subjectively select or cherry-pick their residents from the Oregon State Hospital patients who have met the criteria for discharge and are on the hospital's placement list. Predictably, when given a choice, providers often reject those patients who appear most challenging. As a result, some patients remain at the Oregon State Hospital for months or even years after having met the criteria for discharge. Indeed, at the time of our tour, there were 18 civil patients who had been on the discharge list for more than 1 year, and 15 who had been on the discharge list for more than 6 months. 31 forensic patients have been waiting for more than 3 months for a transfer.
Patient 7, waiting for more than 3 months.
The detrimental effect on individual patients, such as prolonged waiting and frequent rejection, is documented repeatedly in their clinical records. Patients' despair, anger, and agitation after having been turned down by community providers become a part of their illness. These and other effects of prolonged institutionalization result in harm or a serious risk of harm to in hospital patients. Unless and until the hospital implements a discharge planning program that results in timely discharge to appropriate community placements, the state is in violation of Olmstead. Indeed, I skipped the sections where they describe the Olmstead case, but this is very serious. Page 34. Recommended remedial measures. Co-chairs Courtney and Rosenbaum, do you want me to talk about the recommended remedial measures, or do you want to move to questions at this point? So they, USDOJ has taken a great deal of time and energy here to show us where they think we need to go.
They've given us a roadmap.
The state of Oregon should promptly implement the minimal remedial measures set forth below. Protection from harm.
Remedial measures set forth below.
Oregon Hospital should provide its patients with a safe and humane environment and protect them from harm. At a minimum, the hospital should create or revise as appropriate and implement an incident management system that comports with generally accepted professional standards. There's a lot to be said about that topic, and I wanted you to read that. I want to move to the next topic, which is the state hospital needs to develop and implement a comprehensive quality improvement system consistent with generally accepted professional standards of care. That means collecting the information, analyzing the information, and identifying problems and implementing changes. They need to conduct a thorough review of all the units to identify any potential environmental safety hazards and develop and implement a plan to remedy any identified issues. The psychiatric assessment diagnosis. The hospital should ensure that its patients receive accurate, complete, and timely assessments and diagnosis consistent with generally accepted professional standards, and that these assessments and diagnosis drive the treatment interventions.
Can I just clarify one thing, Nikki? They talk about a specific investigation entity that's called the OIT, and then they also seem to call for independent investigators. Can you explain, is there a difference between those two things?
I don't think so. Co-chair Rosenbaum, co-chair Courtney. I happen to also represent the Office of Investigations and Training, and that is a separate DHS entity that is set up to investigate abuse at a state hospital. So they are independent. They are not employees of the state hospital. They wrote it here. They were very impressed by the quality of the investigations done by the Office of Investigations and Training. It is a very, very well regarded, not just in Oregon, but in the outside of Oregon, investigative unit. The problem they point out in the report is it's not clear to them that unit, that separate investigative entity, actually receives all of it. This is sort of the fundamental problem. All of our reports being made at the onset, and what happens to those reports? If something happens to someone, if there's an assault on a ward, is that assault making its way to OIT? That gets back into what I was saying before about the integration of all these different places. The other thing is that there are independent investigations. Patients at the state hospital often commit crimes. When I was just reading to you, indicated that there are a lot of patients here who no longer need treatment and are actually ready to be out of the community. A lot of those patients, maybe the hospital probably, some of them think they're ready to go.
generally accepted professional standards, collecting the information, analyzing the information, and identifying the problems, and implementing the changes. We need to conduct a thorough review of all units to identify any potential environmental safety hazards and develop and implement a plan to remedy any identified issues.
Yeah.
get to that point.
Nursing care, or the hospital should provide nursing services to its patients consistent with generally accepted professional standards. Such services should result in nursing hospital patients receiving individualized services, supports, and therapeutic interventions consistent with their treatment plan. More particularly, My question was answered. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question where we ended up here. The timeline that was specified in here, they seem to be expecting deficiencies to be corrected within 49 days. That would seem to be about the end of February, and this date from when we received this. So what does that mean in terms of what were our responses expected to be to avoid this in litigation? Co-Chair Rosenbaum.
The 49 days is when they need to hear from the governor.
The 49 days is when they need to hear from the governor to find out if we're willing to work with them or if we're going to fight with them.
This week.
And the governor's already responded and sent out a letter this week that we will work cooperatively. That's the response they need within 49 days. Now,
once they receive that letter,
Things could be better, things could be worse, but
and actually,
I think I can say with some confidence that had they not,
I think I can say with some confidence that had they not believed that Oregon was taking steps in the meantime, they would have gotten their letter out sooner, and they would have been here
as I was
cleared in Georgia,
and several other states
haven't
taken
as indicated, Georgia and several other states haven't taken up a lot of their time over the last year. There were 364 deaths in the Georgia State Mental Health System
a year ago
that were reported by the Atlanta Journal there a year ago.
Oregon, if they weren't confident that Oregon was working with them,
if Oregon, if they weren't confident that Oregon was working with them and taking the steps, remember, they did an exit interview with Oregon. They didn't write anything down, but they told us.
We took notice. I was there.
This is what we think you need to do.
A lot of people in this room were
there. We took notice. I was there. A lot of people in this room were there.
And the
State Hospital did have been trying very hard, and the USDA knows that. To implement changes within the capability
one of the reasons
I believe is one of the reasons I'm sure there are others. The Attorney General's Office has been Chief America has been very worthy over the last year. I'm sure that has
worried about Oregon being willing to work.
They weren't worried about Oregon being willing to work.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. First question had to do with the area of quality.
I
can tell you.
Does it make sense to start getting in there and making changes?
Representative Jensen, around the country,
the state hospital, most like all state hospitals around the country, has the most ill people in the state of Oregon.
The U.S. Department of Justice and the Joint Commission don't.
A doctor in a state hospital is far beyond
what the accepted standards would be.
During the last session, they were following that condition. During the last session, there was some discussion and disproving about and within the training center in Bridgeville, Tennessee, about closure of the training center in Bonneville. And one of the and then listening to was contending they brought up was the cost of that. And in relationship to the cost of that, one of the issue was the equipment that they had a full-time position for some 40 patients. And the reason I'm asking the question here is that when I was and then I would suggest those were extremely developmental patients too, some of them who have not only developmental disabilities, but some of them also had mental health problems along with that. So I'm just trying to understand and I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm trying to understand why what sauce for the
good witnesses out there who can come up here and give you that information
The lack of this facility emphasizes the lack of this facility being operated. The hospital was able to get the accreditation. The hospital was able to
the
had a DOJ come in and collect apples and oranges.
Can you add something to that?
Because I'm saying, you said that they're going to collect apples and oranges, and yet they're looking at some of the same thing.
Bingo.
It's a very important issue. Obviously,
bingo.
To me, it's a very important issue. Obviously, useful to me if we're in litigation.
The Joint Commission and the DOJ are totally different entities.
Let's not kid ourselves. The Joint Commission and the DOJ are totally different entities. I've read the report in great detail.
Senator Carter,
I am familiar with the report.
I can't say I've read the report in great detail. I would be misleading you.
I don't think you
are familiar with the report.
Currently, is even thinking about that report.
Part of the problem we have, as you're well aware, is that standards change.
I'm not going to rely on that report at all.
For the better,
hopefully.
We don't need to be pointing that
I would just like to follow that, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, on something Senator Duncan said. My reaction to this patient assessment is inadequate.
I think I'm going to ask some questions, because I'm aware of this meeting today. The governor's letter, can you have a copy of that letter?
I'd like to see the letter.
When the feds are going to visit the grid, they're simply relying on you. How are they going to sign the worldwide? They got to come back.
How does that all happen?
And do another visit.
Not
how they do this, decide, okay, we can leave Oregon, it's done. How does that all happen?
I promised the U.S. DOJ that I wouldn't today tell the attorney and myself that we're going to talk. But I'm the attorney and myself, we're going to talk first. They want to see that we're actually going to cooperate with them and take some steps. Once they see that, then they're going to talk with me about how they want to resolve it. That's what he's told me. Coach Courtney, what you heard before, and you said it really isn't just
a cliche.
Isn't that true?
It's critical.
When State Hospital has
no control over who's coming in the front door and who's going out the back door. If you look at the recommendations
in Oregon,
they talk about that issue.
They don't need treatment, or they don't think they need it.
They know they're going to be here for five years, no matter what.
They're already a criminal.
Guilty except for insanity at the time of the offense is already addressed. They're bored. The state hospital has no control over who's coming in the front door.
Their recommendations.
And who's going out the back door.
Talk about that.
If you look at their recommendations, they talk about that.
Communities in Oregon can
put them in if the state hospital, a district attorney and a defense attorney decide to plea bargain a particular crime, and that
is determined by that plea bargain to be not guilty except for insanity.
The way it's determined by that plea bargain to be not guilty except for insanity.
And the way the
Maybe they're on their medication. Guilty except for insanity at the time of the offense is already addressed. They commit a crime here.
What is the medical of this?
Well, I was there earlier, the fact that you are
already working on
so
this.
So as I said earlier, the fact that you are already working on this kind of strategy is okay.
That helps me be able to
help credibility in terms of the DOJ case. It helps me be able to help credibility with the watch running for DOJ when I say, well, everybody cares about who's working and wants to change your issues. We're not going to deliver with you this DOJ. We're going to get back on it.
If all you do is
existing
testimony is actually...
If all you do is... take testimony and
don't you've got a continuous improvement plan that's being updated right now.
For example, we've got a continuous improvement plan that's being updated right now in line with the
your legislature would
collaborate with the agency and the legislature would collaborate with the agency and the executive
to get that
the things that are needed in there
updated.
It's very
hard to
the things that are needed in there.
It's very
hard to look at this thing when you say,
oh, you guys are
very detailed.
Talk
about how many more nurses are needed. Well, you guys should be looking at that. So you should be helping mention change
those things that are supposed to be happening by such
and such making sure that those things that are supposed to be happening by such and such agencies
there's a time frame
that currently happens, but it can't happen
within
the current resources.
I'm going to address the whole suite of civil rights, address the issue of potential liability, or the treatment lapses that were identified in this report.
Co-chairs, Senator Ferrielli.
I'm very cognizant of that issue.
A lot of people in my office are concerned about
any individual who would attempt to
have to be taken on the merits of their own particular case. I have no intention whatsoever of diminishing the significance of this report.
But
we actually count the number of examples in this report. There are 41 cases in the
hospital system.
There are 681 patients in the hospital system.
Looks like anything else.
So we'd have to look for
I wouldn't feel comfortable making too many sweeping generalizations because third party liability is definitely one that Michelle is concerned to heart.
And one that Michelle will take to heart.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up question. The treatment modalities clearly do not meet generally standards of practice that are generally not And that level of standard is not in compliance with the general standard. Isn't it possible that individuals acting outside of the policy, acting outside of the practices of the institution, and might have personal liability?
Co-chairs, Senator Ferrioli.
I don't think so. I think that what this is speaking to is a path, and not for the people at the hospital. Every single one of them works really hard. And I think because of the nature of how difficult the work is here, the mistakes are made. I think there are systemic problems, and that is what the USDOJ wants to address.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you. Mr. Ferrioli, move the adoption of the rules. Ready to send for the discussion?
My name is John Britton. I work for the legislative fiscal office.
Exclusively, and I work with the joint legislative session in the interim, as well as the emergency board during the interim, and most recently in the interim committee, joint committee. Senator Courtney, your staff, asked me to make some recommendations, and I want to turn to page this morning with you. These are green from my notes. These are green from my analyses that were submitted to the emergency board, sometimes by memory, which isn't all that great, but the chronology starts with November 2004, because there had been a number of times
leading up to that governor's task force.
There have been governor's
task force
on mental health.
There has been
about increasing
discussions about increasing forensics caseload at the Oregon State Hospital.
You see that when you look at November
2000. What I failed to add.
And this is somewhat embarrassing, Senator Courtney, was,
and this is somewhat embarrassing, Senator Courtney, was
meeting at in November 2004.
The emergency board meeting at November 2004,
there was a request from the president's office
of general
for about $2.2 million of general
savings that had been generated from the department
savings that had been generated by the Department of Human Services
rebound.
I should have.
I didn't put that on here.
When I looked at that this morning,
it appeared to me that there was about $500,000 general
allocated
that was ultimately allocated to the Department of Human Services
for 75
community placements at that particular time.
I should note also that what you'll hear,
on the
part of
is a focus
on emergency board
on part of
means
on the emergency board
primarily
on two areas. One was on developing more community placements
located for
the forensics population who
were
ready to be discharged,
as well as
those who were civilly committed to the Oregon State Hospital.
So there were
made over time
investments
made by the legislature
in developing those
The second area, and you've already heard about that,
is in staffing at the Oregon State Hospital.
In November 2004, there was a request
from the
president's office.
Ultimately, about $500,000 of general fund
was allocated
to develop 75
departments.
To develop 75 community placements. Also, at the November 2004 emergency board meeting, there was a report that was presented by the Department of Human Services and specifically, and this was in response to Senator Gordley, the OSH forensic population response.
It was primarily in response,
which had been
to a budget note,
a lawsuit,
which had been in response to a lawsuit,
and that's
about 7 or 8 lines down in my notes here. Miranda versus
Kitzhaber,
which had called for the development of 75 placements by June 30th, 2005,
and the discharge of 31 class members from the Oregon State Hospital.
In addition, what that report showed was
that the forensic population was growing
at a significant rate.
The report stated that during 2001-03,
the forensic population had grown by a niche of 1.5 average,
but during 2003-05,
but during 2003-05,
was 6.2.
The growth rate was 6.2
average cases per month.
About the cause,
and there was speculation
about the cause for that significant increase.
One was a compliance order versus the Oregon State Hospital, which required individuals accused of crimes and found to be mentally unfit to stand trial by the court.
Within 7 days of
finding
by the court,
the Oregon State Hospital,
prior to that,
the Oregon State Hospital
could some delay
the entrance of the people.
There was some ability to do that.
The court said absolutely not.
We've got to get these folks in and begin treatment promptly.
There was discussion about the loss of a medical program, which was an extraordinarily high cost for many persons with severe and persistent mental illness.
That program was eliminated during our budget crisis.
And also,
the elimination of the
first, the elimination of the OH standard mental health benefit was cited as a cause of this increase of the reduction of the OH standard program altogether. Also, in November, from the Oregon General Fund was transferred from the Oregon State operating budget to create the third forensic ward to deal with the increase in the forensic population and to develop more community.
In January, there was a brief update on
the forensic population at the Oregon State Hospital.
In December 2004,
report noted that in December 2004, the forensic census was 477 persons, about 43 patients above the budget.
Then we went into the 2005 legislative session.
The geropsychiatric ward was retained. In addition, the 2005 legislative budget included funding to begin the master plan phase two report.
By October of that year, 2005 emergency board meeting. $3.9 million general fund to develop 71 additional forensic remediation programs, increasing federal emergency operations, and $3 million hospital to address a variety of Oregon state budget. $3.9 million general fund to increase OSH staffing by 30%.
The latter two pieces were in response to yet another lawsuit.
Violation of professional and constitutional standards.
Emergency board took that very seriously.
The emergency board took that very seriously.
At the time, I remember reading briefs. $9.3 million So 9.3 is a significant commitment.
I noted here that the master plan phase two report.
They noted difficulty in hiring occupational therapists. section of clear environmental citing non-competitive pay.
They anticipate
poor environmental working conditions.
71.
They anticipated opening draft 15 by 71 placements in June, with the rest coming online by the end of the biennium.
In response to the emergency board questions,
they had tried to at least look at Morgan State PhD level, hospital psychologist
salaries, with other psychologists, 10%.
The comparison showed OSH salaries were 10%
elsewhere,
lower than master's for the psychologist salaries elsewhere in Oregon,
but slightly higher than those they compared with in Washington.
The department's report also indicated that since March 2006, Oregon State Hospital Psychologists had resigned. Staff also, Occupational therapist positions were very difficult to fill, and at that time, Oregon State Hospital staff were attempting to use the vocational rehabilitation specialist instead.
And as Ms. Logan thought to be noted, DHS had presented a broader picture of its efforts to develop community-based placements. The 2005-07 budget had funded 222 new placements. EBOR had provided funding for another 71. A total of 299 placements.
It had established
by December 2006. DHS reported it had established 128.
Biennium.
The department had developed 312 placements, so the goal of almost 300 placements was a real stretch for them to.
And the Human Services Subcommittee talked a lot about those placements. We spent a great deal of time asking questions about the barriers Why weren't they being developed faster? What was going on there? Community opposition to forensic placement was noted as the primary, the significant barrier to development. And DHS indicated that it probably would not be able to reach the staffing ratios agreed in the Harmon versus Stickle lawsuit settlement agreement. The United States Department of Justice on-site visit occurred during the week of November 13, 2006. Finally, in December 2006, at the emergency board meeting, another update report, 24 patients rather than the 30 were going to be moved to the Portland facility. As it turned out, the space would not accommodate 30. It would only accommodate 24. Occupational therapist positions were very difficult to fill, and at that time, the Oregon State Hospital staff were attempting to use vocational rehabilitation specialists instead. They were thought to be easier to recruit, and as Ms. Logan noted, DHS at that point in time had finalized a contract with OHSU to provide a chief psychiatrist and up to six other psychiatrists. DHS presented a broader picture of its efforts to develop community placements. The 2005-07 budget had funded 222 new placements. E-Board had provided funding for another 71, a total of 299 new placements. By December 2006, DHS reported it had established 128. And during the 2003-05 biennium, the department had developed 212. So the goal of almost 300 placements was a real stretch for them to produce all those placements. The last bullet under the 2006 E-Board meeting talks about the DHS rebalance report. And it indicated that Oregon State Hospital costs exceeded budget by $7.3 million general fund, $2 million related to higher personal services costs, and again, I've noted overtime pay and contractor pay, and this is something that Ms. Logan alluded to, and $5.3 million for higher services and supplies costs, particularly medical costs and pharmaceutical costs. The higher OSH costs were partially offset in that rebalance plan by savings from delays in developing community-based placements. And I can remember a particular comment from Senator Boardley. It's the old good news, bad news. We have savings, but they're not where we want them to be, because they were generated from delays in opening all those placements that had been funded. The 2007 legislative session, the first bullet at the top of page 5 talks about the rebalance plan, the final rebalance plan. The costs at that time were estimated to be $9.2 million general fund higher than budget. And in addition, other funds and federal funds revenue were about $8.2 million lower than anticipated, requiring more general fund. The legislature approved the rebalance, and the repricing of the governor's budget also reflected the cost increases into 09 or into 07-09 and the lower revenue estimates. We included a budget note with the DHS budget directing DHS to report on OSH revenue and expenditures during the 2007-09 biennium, and they just did that a couple of weeks ago. We'll talk about that in a moment. The adopted budget also included $9.6 million general fund to continue the expansion of community-based placements, $6.3 million total funds, most of that was general fund, to ramp up staffing, nursing, safety, and security staff. Ms. Logan mentioned 17 more nurses. That's what this partly was used for. As well as funding for three 16-bed state-operated forensic units. I note here in the third bullet that the Oregon State Hospital adopted budget for 2007-09, just to give you some perspective, is about $235 million. Actual expenditures for 2005-07 were about $210 million, and the 2007-08 budget is 12% higher. 2003-05 expenditures were about $177 million. This is for both the Portland facility and also in Salem. However, it doesn't include the Blue Mountain Recovery Center. Also, the adopted budget included enhancements to community-based outpatient care. We put in about $11 million of general fund for a variety of community-based services. And, of course, the Oregon State Hospital replacement project. In October and December, at the Interim Joint Committee on Ways and Means, DHS presented reports on the Oregon State Hospital replacement project, and they'll continue to do that. Also, as I've noted, and as you well know, the U.S. DOJ issued the report that we're talking about this morning. Finally, earlier this month, DHS presented a report in response to that budget note concerning OSH revenues and expenditures. The report outlined a variety of ways that Oregon State Hospital staff were attempting to control expenditures and improve fiscal accountability. The expenditure information included with the report indicated that the budget, the biennial expenses, were now estimated to be about $245 million total funds, about 10.7 higher than the budget. But I've noted that the estimated expenditure includes the costs of higher staff salaries, but omitted in terms of revenue any distribution of the $125 million special purpose appropriation that the E-Board, or that the, well, that the Emergency Board has for negotiated salary increases. So some of that deficit would be covered by a distribution of that money. In addition, the higher costs included those for a new hearings process for patients who are being involuntarily medicated. These costs were included in the DHS rebalance plan, which was also presented in January. Overall, management believes it needs to manage to reduce its costs by about $1.4 million. And some of this may not involve a reduction of cost, but new revenue coming in from Medicare Part D drug reimbursement. They will be, the department will be reporting on that throughout this biennium on OSH revenue and expenditures. Now, before I conclude, I want to make a couple observations and some recommendations. First off, when you look at the chronology, I was struck by the fact that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means and Emergency Board activities are, to a large degree, reactive, particularly to lawsuits. Miranda, Harmon, OAC versus Mink, rather than proactive in response to routine oversight that is ongoing. Miranda versus Kitzhaber, OAC versus Mink, Harmon versus Fickle, and now the United States Department of Justice investigation under CRIPA. Second observation is that the oversight function of the Oregon State Hospital by the Joint Committee on Ways and Means and the Emergency Board has not been a comprehensive one. And I say this as an observation, not necessarily as a criticism of Ways and Means. Ways and Means handles the entire state budget And the emergency board, and I'm emphasizing the word emergency, is designed to put out fires. But it doesn't provide routine, ongoing oversight of the Oregon State Hospital operations. As I've noted, it was primarily focused on revenue and expenditure, the improvement and accountability of that. It was focused on the development of community-based placements. We talked a lot about significant barriers, including NIMBY, not in my backyard. I would note that Representative Tomei's committee has dealt with that extensively back in December. And we focused on increased staffing, the tough sell, trying to get salaries that are competitive with a private sector, clinical shortages, working conditions, and so on. But I want to make the point that it hasn't been a comprehensive oversight conducted by either the E-Board or Ways and Means. And finally, the last observation is that while we did focus on revenue and expenditures, we focused on the number of community-based placements, we focused on staffing and salaries, we didn't really look at patient treatment and care. We know that the community-based placements and improved staffing hopefully will also lead to good patient care. But we didn't focus on that particular aspect so much. In documenting, was patient care actually improving? Finally, for your consideration, I added some recommendations here. First one, create a dedicated oversight function. This is something that I hope you'll think about. Oregon State Hospital Board of Directors, question mark. The Oregon State Hospital Commission, some group that can augment the DHS management team, and it probably ought to be comprised of both legislators but also non-legislators. Provide ongoing oversight for the Oregon State Hospital, not just for the next year or so or whenever the Department of Justice leaves Oregon or until the new hospital has been built, but ongoing into the future, regularly to have somebody's pulse on what's going on at the Oregon State Hospital and to hold DHS management accountable. Also, their function would be to communicate with the legislature, to be people that could be trusted so that when you ask them what was going on at the state hospital, they could give you the straight answer, and you would be able to trust that response. To make funding recommendations to the governor and legislature, and I wouldn't be a Ways and Means person if I didn't add, with the understanding that funds are not unlimited. It would be to make recommendations where we really need to put the money with respect to the Oregon State Hospital. Ongoing review, give us some recommendations as to what is really critical and needs to be addressed by the legislature in its budget deliberation process. The second, to compile and organize comprehensive management data and use it to establish and achieve performance goals. This is pretty basic, but you also heard that from Ms. Logan. Sorry, from Ms. Logan, that the management information systems that are available out here are antiquated, and everyone chuckled when she said that. To run an organization like this one, we have to have data, and this committee has to be able, or whatever group there is, to look at the Oregon State Hospital has to be able to evaluate data. And those data include financial, revenue, actual expenditures versus budget, have data to understand whether good business practices are going on, cost control, maximizing the revenue that does come into the Oregon State Hospital apart from general fund to understand the situation with staffing, turnover, vacancies, how are we coming on new hiring, training, development of community-based placements, where do we stand? We funded 71 placements. Have they been developed? Have they not? I think that data probably does exist, but I'm here to tell you I don't know how we did. We tracked it pretty well throughout 2006, but then we got involved in the 2007 session, and I don't know whether all the placements that had been funded were actually developed. Census data. Data about patient needs and characteristics. Discharge information, seclusion and restraint data. And finally, and I'm way out of my league on this one, good information about patient therapeutics. Are patients actually getting better? Are patients being treated with dignity? Are patients progressing toward their treatment goals? And are patients themselves satisfied with their treatment and their progress? We have to have some data to be able to answer those questions. Third recommendation is that if you do create some kind of oversight function, assign people to it who have expertise in hospital business functions, psychiatric therapies, people who have high expectations for patient care and positive outcomes, people who will challenge the Oregon State Hospital staff, and as you noted, Mr. Chair, those who are willing to really work at it, because this is not an easy task. With that, I'd turn it back to you, Senator Courtney.
All right, first of all, thank you very much for preparing this document. I think this is a very important 7 pages that you presented for us, both in terms of history, but also key observations and recommendations. I know you're very busy because of what will be coming in February. To jump in, I really, really appreciate this.
You're welcome, Senator.
We have some questions or comments for our good professional staff. Representative Johnson,
yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have one question, and I think maybe you've kind of answered the question, but let me pose the question anyway. And that is, in the Ways and Means process, we have these sets of goals or objectives that are measurable, that each agency coming before us has to have as such. And my question, I think, is based on what we're looking at here and here and, you know, and your comment, for this particular microcosm of the whole budget, are the objectives, the measurable goals that they have there and the objectives adequate? Are they clearly enough carried out or spelled out that we can measure them? And Senator Carter, who I think chaired that committee, might have some, you know, advice for me or some comments on that question, too.
Senator Courtney and Representative Jensen, you're right. Ways and Means has spent a lot of time on performance measurements. I would note that the Department of Human Services is revamping nearly all. It may not eliminate all of its performance measurements. But I want to make a distinction, and I think you are making this distinction, between high-level performance measures for the entire department, and I don't recall that there are any that are specific to the Oregon State Hospital. So I'd make that comment. But that's distinguished from operational measures for the Oregon State Hospital. And that's what I would like to see. I don't know whether they exist, Representative. I haven't seen them. I think Bruce and Ms. Dr. Goldberg and Bob Nickel can talk about that with you. But there is a difference between high-level measurements and operational measures for the Oregon State Hospital.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think this is very important area, but not one I want to labor right now, because I think you'll be dealing with it as we move further along. Thank you, Senator West.
Thank you. I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Britton. I think you have walked us through not only history, but also you've come up with some good recommendations. As the person who was the chair in 01 and 03 and Senator Carter in 05, you have well encapsulated the issues and the problem. One that I see missing, though, that I think that we need to add, and it's one that I've talked about a long time, we have some extremely dedicated employees here at the Oregon State Hospital, and I know that there's also violence that is occurring against employees. You know, when we talk about safety, I think we need to talk about safety of both, you know, as well as the safety of the patient and as well as the safety of our employees. And I've asked continually for our records that deal with our workers' comp rate, our rates that, you know, if we begin to have a safer environment on both sides, that's also a cost driver downward. But overall, I want to commend you because I think that what you presented to us this morning really, not only the events, but really capture, and I'm very intrigued about your recommendation of having a commission on oversight so that we move out of the position of being in a reactive mode, which is where we've been ever since, you know, I have chaired and Senator Carter, in fact, you didn't think it was an old four that we got the governor to do the report. But we can't continue with the practice in Oregon of simply reacting when we come in every 2 years. And I think your recommendation to me holds a lot of merit. So I want to thank you for that.
Representative Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would concur. I'm intrigued by this idea of a board of directors, sort of an oversight, because one of the problems is that this body, the legislative ways and means, changes over time, and yet attention needs to be constantly sort of put to monitoring these issues. I would say, however, it needs to be bigger, judging from the testimony and the slogan, than just the hospital. It needs to be part, it needs to be interfaced with the criminal justice system, which certainly is impacting this, and the community-based operations that are outside of the physical building. That being said, I would encourage someone, including me, to look at other models from other states. I don't think we're reinventing the wheel here. There have to be models of this that we could judge against, and I would encourage that because I think I like the direction this is going.
Senator Carter, please.
Mr. President, members of the committee, John Gooden has most superbly presented to us today a report that magnifies a reactionary body called the Auburn Legislature. And the legislature, in its wisdom, comes in to put out fires. You're exactly right. That's what we do. But in the wisdom of the president, he changed the emergency board concept to being Ways and Means Committee. And because the emergency board is not designed to do what Ways and Means Committee does. And until, Mr. President, we can have ongoing oversight, and when we actually put into answering the representative question, put into place an oversight committee that does the high-level stuff, in addition to coming back to the legislation and reporting what has been done as a result of the interim process, and having a group of people along with the legislature to do this work, it's not going to be done. We're not learning lessons from these reports that we're getting that continues to say to us, I know you have good intent, but you're not doing a good job. We have management issues that we need to work on, but we also need to make a distinction between us being an institution that brings in civil and criminal cases, and we act like an institution that houses just criminal activities, criminal people or prisoners versus what is a hospital practice. So we have two different settings that we have to work with, and I think it is well noted here today to the representative from Salem that there needs to be some interfacing with the criminal justice system, but I maintain that two separate actions are in place, and at some point we do have to be able to work with the criminal justice system, because we can't just have people, and a good case in point is Mr. Bitten. We were budgeted at 447, I think he said, and we were 43 patients above that budgeted amount. So then what happens, then you go to the emergency board, the emergency board says, we don't have any money, and they get kind of mad because your management practice is out of sync with the amount of dollars that we gave you. So it's a two-way dirty street, I have to tell you, that if the Justice Department, if our prison system from around the state is going to admit a criminally insane person, and all of them have a civil commitment, then we should have some kind of cap that we say, if anybody have problems beyond this cap, then we don't know what we're going to do with them. I mean, it is absolutely irresponsible of us as a state to do this to the people that are coming to us. And I maintain, Mr. President, that your actions have been great and certainly have been courageous to this point. But we can no longer leave this hospital alone in how it operationalizes itself. We've got to put some practices into place, and this is a very good starting point with what Mr. Britton has presented to us, and also the criticisms that have come from the U.S. DOJ. We've got to do something, and I think this is the right start in the right direction in which we're going, but we've got to do something that is ongoing, that is continuous in terms of an oversight body from the legislature, as well as some committed members with expertise in hospital administration and practices to go along with this. So, Mr. Britton, thank you very much for a very good report.
Well, we're at 11:24, and we have some other people that could have managed, so please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate all those comments, and I agree with them. I also think that if such an oversight group were set up, it really needs to include representatives of the people that work in these hospitals, who often know more about what's going on there than management people do. And so I think that would be really important, too. And I also want to just respond to your comment about money. We have to bear in mind money is not unlimited, because throwing money at problems does not always fix them. However, it's very clear reading these DOJ findings that part of the problem with these staffing recruitment retention problems is that these are inherently some of the hardest jobs that exist in the state, requiring a lot of expertise and compensation that's inadequate. And if you put those things together, we have to be prepared to take this on in a very serious way that does include resources and addressing the working conditions, so that these are jobs that people will want to do and be able to stay at. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ferry, would you please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the report, Mr. Britton. I thought that was very helpful, including the recommendations. We authorized the construction of senior facilities to replace those facilities. So the question for me is, how are we to separate those immediate goals that we need to meet that might be duplicative of those goals that we will be meeting with these new facilities? In other words, if information technology systems are needed, that's a different matter of investment in physical planning than staffing and training, which would be beneficial in the new setting. So, you know, I think what we need to do is get some idea of how you might make recommendations to separate those two issues, so we're not essentially duplicating facilities and services within the next 3 years.
Senator Courtney and Senator Ferrioli, I need to think about that a bit. I thought, well, as I read the report, what if we snapped our fingers and we had the new hospitals were all in place and we all marched across the street and there we were. We have some problems that we got to solve no matter whether we have the new hospitals or not. They won't solve them all. They will help,
I believe that. I would note that the, with respect to the management information system, that's part of the new hospital. That's a piece of the replacement project. Some persons have said that perhaps the staffing ratios do not need to be as high in the new buildings as they do today, simply because the setting, the environment, will be more conducive to both staff safety and patient safety. I don't know if that's really the case. Do you ramp up a lot now and then ramp down? It's hard for me to envision, but I'll have to think about your question. In terms of, we don't want to duplicate costs and so on. I appreciate your comments, but I have to think about it.
Mr. Chairman, I think that there would be a great profit from an interface between Mr. Britton's work and the work that's ongoing with Ms. Logan and the USDOJ. And if there was a way that we could phase in those things that are of immediate need, staffing, training, cultural change, those things that would benefit us in either setting, the new setting or the old setting, that might give us a priority list of things to work on. And that priority list, I'd like to hear whether or not the USDOJ sees that priority list as sufficient progress, taking into consideration the
I need to think about that a bit.
Think about that.
I've thought, well, as I read the report, what if we snapped our fingers and we had the new hospitals were all in place and we all marched across the street and there we were.
We all marched across.
We have some problems that we've got to solve. No matter whether we have the new hospitals or not,
whether we have
they won't solve them all. They will help. I believe
they
that.
Won't solve them all. They will.
I would note that with respect to the management information system, that's a part of the new hospital. That's a piece of the replacement.
That's a piece
project
of the replacement project.
Some persons have said that perhaps the staffing ratios do not need to be as high in the new buildings as they do today, simply because the setting, the environment, will be more conducive to both staff safety and patient safety. I don't know if that's really the case. Do you ramp up a lot now and then ramp down? It's hard for me to envision, but I'll have to think about your question. In terms of, we don't want to duplicate costs and so on. I appreciate your comments, but I have to think about it.
Mr. Chairman, I think that there would be a great profit from an interface between Mr. Britton's work and the work that's ongoing with Ms. Logan and the USDOJ. And if there was a way that we could phase in those things that are of immediate need, staffing, training, cultural change, those things that would benefit us in either setting, the new setting or the old setting, that might give us a priority list of things to work on. And that priority list, I'd like to hear whether or not the USDOJ sees that priority list as sufficient progress, taking into consideration the commitment to the new facilities, so that we arrive in 2011 with most of these problems solved.
Thank you, Mr. Britton. I really, once again, want to emphasize that I really good report. It's a very important document. I really appreciate your observations and recommendations going in there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Again, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, come forward. This is the time in which this is the Q&A session as a formal presentation. I do think somewhere, I'm not sure where we're going, we're going to have to tell us the timeline for our next meeting. What you'll have for us. I do agree with the testimonies of certain members of this committee that we're in this together. we're going to have to work our way out of it together. All right, sincerely, you know, but I have to tell you this is my observation. Some of these things that concern me. Going back to the read the report on John Brown. What John did, he appeals to me as a lawyer. He also talked about where the legislature needs to step up. One of the things that I'm struggling with now, I am a legislator. I can't be out here supervising this hospital. I can't be a director of mental health. I cannot do that. Our role is to provide the resources, statutory changes, maybe oversight. I can't embed myself. First of all, I don't have the training for the backup. There are members of this committee that actually do have a lot of training, but I don't, and it's not the role of legislation. So I have to rely on you doing your thing, and I'm doing our thing. In that regard, I have to tell you something. Now, to go over, you and I have talked a lot since you were good enough to call me and told me this bombshell was coming. We talked so much, I think we're related. If we're not, we should be. If we're not, and now I'm going to read to you some things that concerns me in terms of trying to get my confidence level up. If you go back to a letter that the governor sent in September 21, 2004, to a guy named Gary Weeks, directing the resources, he said, as you are aware, recent media reports have unveiled disturbing stories of past abuse in Ridgely Hospital. I believe we must ensure that the state is providing the best possible care to organs with mental illness being served in the hospital. The state must have zero tolerance to the abuse or neglect of individuals not here. There must be established an effective protocol for identifying and responding to allegations of abuse and the treatment. Now, that was a letter from the governor to his then director of Department of Resources. Now, I have a letter, that was on September 21st, October 14th, 2004. I sent the following letter to the New York State Senate. Last week, I met with Dr. Martin Fickles, discuss the recent ongoing reports about abuses of adolescent patients at the hospital. Dr. Fickles assured me that strong protection monitoring measures have been implemented, resulting in no abuse of the kind described in the Oregonian since 1994. In the meantime, my lengthy and frank conversation with Dr. Fickles was deeply troubling as we discussed the extent of what can only be called a mental health crisis in Oregon. More disturbing than the condition of the facilities of the problem of overcrowding. Dr. Fickles explained to me the hospital currently houses 760 patients with only 1,150 staff members. Hospital the lowest staff patient ratio in the country. Currently, our state hospital is 30% understaffed. That document was sent on the 14th of October 2004. Then we have in November 2004 an e-board proposal ordering the state hospital to the office of the president, which has already been outlined by John Burton, all the things that were asked. Now, the thing that I don't understand, and I'm struggling with here, I'm not trying to turn this into, you know that. It's so frustrating. If you read this report, I may be wrong. Every single incident here was in 2005 and 2006. And in fact, the counsel who testified to us said, she started talking about changes in 2007, and it seems to me, it's interesting, there's another date in here. On June 13, 2006, we were notified that you were initiating an investigation of the district of the hospital. The only thing I have to say is, I know that your story was bad. But here we have, these things happened in 2004. I'm sitting there in 2007. I think written the document says that everything that was asked for by the state legislature, the e-board, the raising, everything that was asked for, we gave it. Democrat, Republican, whatever, we gave it. Now, we may not be doing a good job of oversight, but I'm putting this case out, and I'll accept that, and I'll refer to the good service to my wife, who are very well versed as well, sort of on these issues that we can look at, as Representative Jensen, and you got Senator Carter, and winners, and them. I'll take that. But, do you understand what I can't embed myself out here. And I have to wonder. So this thing was 2005, 2006, and then the only improvement, according to council, was in 2007. Could it be because you then knew the feds were coming in because you learned about it in 2006? So I'm just going to say that if you think you have a confidence problem, you're right, Dr. Goldberg. Mr. Nichol, Mr. Hammond, I do have one. And I my fellow senators, mayor, disagree, and I'm fellow election disagree. But somewhere you have to understand that unless you want us to live over here, which is not in your best interest, and we shouldn't be over here, there's going to have to be an understanding that if we do what you ask us, there's got to be accountability, there's got to be measurements. There has to be. There has to be. So thank you for allowing me to say that again. I'm not about trying to make your lives miserable. You have very difficult jobs. We have a very difficult mission. And so with that, I don't know if you want to respond, any one or three of you, to this analysis that I've done, but I just, that's something I had to say, and why the report devastated me, but also it devastated me because what's in it, and because I saw we were trying very hard since 2000. I'm trying to build a new mental health facilities and all that we've gone through, the site and all. I haven't even talked about that. I'm talking about these other issues. I'll take your hits. You hit me.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm certainly not here to just the opposite, Senator Courtney. Certainly, your leadership has been instrumental in doing a lot of the things that have been accomplished in terms of an attention and a focus to individuals with mental illness, some of the improvements in the community, the building of the plans to build a new state hospital.
So let me
back up a second and respond to a couple of things.
First and foremost, I
share with you and I think everybody else in this state the fact that the findings that were in this report are serious, are unacceptable for us as a state, as a department,
and they're
very disturbing.
And I guess
I would also share with you
the words that I've shared
with our staff and with others as I've talked about this.
They're pretty simple.
It goes like this. I think when I've spoken to our staff, I've said the same thing.
We have to take responsibility for where we are and what's happened in the past.
And we have to take responsibility for making it better.
And the we, I think,
is transferable in the variety of settings that we can talk about this.
And I don't think that they are mutually exclusive.
I think that as you've begun to see today, and the testimony from Ms. Rogan in the findings of the report, and the testimony from Mr. Britton, that this is a complex problem with a variety of issues involved around our entire mental health system. About issues of our criminal justice and our healthcare system, issues about stigma, population, issues about day-to-day management of a department, of a hospital, issues about culture, issues about data and information, issues about responsibility and accountability, and we have to make our way through all of these.
I think that we're all dedicated to the same thing, which is how we create a system and a state whereby people get the highest quality care, and where we move towards helping people recover.
This report certainly indicates a lot of the work that we have to do.
I can assure you,
Courtney, Senator Cordney, members of the committee, that I take this extremely seriously.
I'm not here to be defensive.
I'm not here to be defensive. We're certainly prepared to talk to you at whatever time.
It is appropriate
to lay out what I believe have been the steps that have begun way in advance of this report to address many of the issues that are
in the report.
And
we stand ready
to work on that.
Very much appreciated
Mr. Britton's analysis.
Those are some of the ideas we've begun to think about as well.
issues pertaining to data, information, management, or issues that are unique to the Oregon State Hospital, but are unique to our costs, go across government services programs, the needs in our communities that we're not meeting, the needs in our management of programs that need to be improved. I think, as you know, and Mr. Britton focused on this. When I took over the department 2 years ago, it was at that point in Mr. Britton's timeline that we were $172 million in debt. That was primarily a result of a lack of the kinds of financial and fiscal management information systems and a degree of management discipline to be able to deal with that. I believe we've made great strides in that regard, but that's the tip of the iceberg, and I believe that the ability to better have information management and the discipline to be able to carry out plans to manage not just the finances, but the human needs of people is what we need to work on, and I stand before you committed to join you in that, and I hope that I can certainly earn your confidence in that.
There are some things that can be done in terms of management practices that won't cost the money. Simple things like the washing of hands. People that are in restraints and cleaning up in the areas where they are.
Discharge planning. Why should we not have confidence about the hospital not knowing who's coming in and who's going out?
Those are just simple practices that you're doing. Have your children at home. You don't know where they are they in bed? You know, it just appears to me, Bob Mitchell and to Mr. Newman, that these are management practices that the legislature shouldn't even have to hear about along these lines. So I want to know, as long as the president has me as chair of the Human Services Committee, and Mr. President, I'd like for you to give me that opportunity during this interim to do something to make sure that these simple things are taken care of, so that when Ms. Logan goes back to defend the state, she can say to USDOJ, these are the things that we address right away and that we can do in terms of helping the day-to-day practices of what people do to take care of to have patient care. There's something we can do that she doesn't even have to defend. I want to know, Dr. Mitchell, from you and Mr. Nichols, whom I trust implicitly in terms of his work, and from Mr. Maynard, that these are things that you can give us a report within the next 2 weeks about. I want to know that you have done something about this and with the staff within the next 2 weeks. And Mr. McCullough, I want to follow up with that as chair of this committee, that these are things that we can do today, tomorrow, without waiting because you need money to get it done.
Co-chairs, Senator Carter, some of those things we have indeed already done. Let's turn things over to Mr.
Nichols.
Let me just back up a second.
This not is
This is not in time. I mean, this isn't a single point in time. I mean, I can back up prior to this report and on learning of a variety of issues that were occurring in the hospital even before the Department of Justice came and began to address an emergency things, that when the Department of Justice was here, we welcomed them. And as I think you Ms. Logan indicated, we
actually begged them,
asked them
to do an exit interview. To know
because we wanted to know
as well, I think
what it is they were finding as well, I think, to become an organization that wants to improve itself. You have to create a culture where you are open to external looks at what you're doing and committed to making those improvements. We had that exit interview. On the basis of that, we've already begun to do a variety of things.
And I think we're
waiting for this report, and I think we're in a position and will be to show you some of the things that have happened. Mr. Nichol.
For the record, I'm Bob Nichol, Assistant Director of Taboos in the Department of Human Services, and I'm responsible for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. Yes, to answer your question, Senator Carter, we can give you, within a week, a detailed listing of the improvements that we've made and how we're approaching that. One of the things that the hospital staff has already begun to do is to develop metrics for each of those five major areas and then to cross the block that with the continuous improvement plan, which matched very well, by the way, with the kind of improvements that were recommended and will be required by the Department of Justice. So the answer to your question earlier is an emphatic yes, we can show you that, and we're happy to do that.
I'm sure you know, Senator Courtney and Senator Carter's frustration, because we have certain expectations. But what I'd like to move us to is to move us from specific to where we are in a specific document that talks about not just the matrix of what improvements have taken place over time. And I would also like for you to do something else. I would like to know how involved the staff, and I'm talking about line staff, those who are out there that are doing the work, that are assisting you in making some of the corrections. We often plan and do things in isolation of the very good soldiers that are out there doing the work, and sometimes we've got ideas or concepts that can help us do our job better. And I also, put your documents together, address specifically the areas that have been outlined by the Department of Justice. I think for all of us, when we start talking about not washing your hands, when we start talking about feces and things like that you don't expect to see in the hospital.
I would like to see.
So I would like to see what's corrected. I would like to see, based on the report, the Department of Justice report, what currently has management done in this building to correct the problems and management problems in the building.
Where are the gaps?
And then I'd also like you to point out where are the gaps?
What you think we want to hear.
And I don't want you coming to us.
I want you to
tell us what you think we want to hear.
Actually is.
I want you to come to us and tell us what actually is. Because so often sometimes, I think sometimes we like to play around with words, and I don't think words is the name of this stuff.
I can go again then. I want you to tell me what you're going to do about the staff and what he shifts. Don't just come in and say, I don't want to hear that. I don't know what you're going to deal with, Mr. Portland, because I don't want to hear that.
So we're here.
We are not going to have a new facility until 2011, so we're here. that we have to improve these conditions. You know that, to know patient safety, patient care, employee safety. I want to know, since the staffing is staff, what are you going to do?
Salary increases.
Where are they going to come from? You requested salary increases. One of the recommendations back in 2004 that we increased salaries by 10%. We did it
about that.
I want to know specifically about that. I want to know about restraints. Our restraints that have been stopped today. What is going on? I mean, really, I'm not interested in that. What is the name of that? No, it's a question. The council was and said, what is it? No, don't say that stuff to me. Don't use those words to me. Use it some other place, not me. Use it in ways and means, if that's the way to talk. I want you to tell me, we are this short, we will have hired this number of people, how much time will they come to do it? I don't know how to deal with this.
I don't know how to relate to it.
I don't know how to deal with it.
We can come and put before you is
clearly having clear measurements.
This is where we are.
It's around.
Clearly having clear measurements of where we are, whether it's around staffing, whether it's around hours and seclusion and restraint, whether it's around incidents of patient-on-patient violence, whether it's around a variety of real, clear pieces of information, being able to then lay out what we need to do to make that better, what the strategies are, what we need to do that, and to be able to monitor and show the type of improvement so that you can see staffing ratios changing, and if they're not changing, the strategies that need to be put in place to address them. That's what we are doing, prepared to come to you to work on. And if I could just go back to your previous question for a moment, because there was one piece that I don't think I directly addressed that I'd like to. You had asked me
that has been asked for, you referring to the legislature.
We given everything that has been asked for, you referring to the legislature. And the answer to that is absolutely yes. And I think that
is
the,
I believe
the issue behind that is
about the state.
I believe, quite frankly, and once again, this isn't just about the state hospital.
Whether it be within the hospital,
I believe that for many years, whether it be within the hospital or it be with any of our many human services programs, that the needs have been tremendous. That we've been through a series of time in this state where there have been numbers of cuts. I also think that we've been cognizant, and probably too cognizant, of the finite resources. And I believe, quite frankly, that we as a department have not done the job that we need to do to be able to advocate for exactly what is needed. I think we need to do a better job at that. I also think we need to do a better job at also demonstrating, this is two ways we need to approach this. We also need to do a better job of demonstrating the accountability that we utilize those resources with, and that we use them as efficiently and as effectively as possible. And I believe that, as we've discussed in other settings, those are a variety of the ways we've been approaching a number of these problems. It's not just saying we need more money, because in some cases we have dysfunctional systems and processes where we don't want to just continue to put more and more into them. We need to fix them and become more efficient. By the same token, there are places we need increasing amounts of resources. And it's not just not we as a department, but the fact that we don't provide people the kinds of mental health care they need in the community. These are huge issues, but I felt very passionately about these, as I know you do, but I wanted to be clear to get back to clearly and stating on the record that indeed you have everything that's been asked for, you have been given. I think we need to do a better job of asking you.
I've seen the governor's wish list for February. You know what's going to happen in February, so I don't know where that all plays out. You need, in terms of, we're going to a budget session. So I don't know if there's anything there or not. I'm talking about that generally, but not specifically, so I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, that sounds to me good question and answers, period, today with the committee, that at the next appointed meeting, we do as openly to Dr. Goldberg, Dr. Whipple, and Mr. Hammer, and let them make their presentation regarding the update of where they are in terms of the accusations and the, let's see how long we can get along with continuous improvement, the improvement that they have made. Improvement means, Mr. President, how they have responded to and dealt with the report that came to us from the DOJ, because we did ask questions today. And I am sure, given the next appointed time, they can be prepared to come back to us in response to how they handled this situation.
President Jackson, please. First off, I want to express my thanks and appreciation to the Senate President for the leadership he's taking in this particular endeavor that we're involved in. I must say that it takes someone in a position like the one that he has with a passion for doing this job and doing it right, perhaps a lot of the legislators can be effective, perhaps as I will on our mission. And I also would like to thank my two distinguished senators who have spent so much time on this issue in their careers here that I've been familiar with.
Mr. Britton's report and the DOJ report and what you indicates where you got any possibility
to solve this problem
to be a solution.
You've got a possibility that this is going to be a solution.
It's an operation in there right now.
And where there areas and anything where going on in between
haven't touched the surface yet.
Proceed to
and anything that's going on in between it. So as we proceed through the weeks that we will be meeting dealing with this, we'll be able to follow a flow sheet
down the road,
and we'll be able to look at it as we get further down the road. And I think that'll help all of us, because as Senator Courtney's and this is painful for me, concern about where do I trust him? We've had a lot of discussions and associations over the last couple of years, I've got to ask myself, do you have a, is there something wrong with your evaluation of people? So we need to get to the bottom of it, and I think it would help if you could do that.
President Jensen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. First off, I want to express my thanks and appreciation to the Senate President for the leadership he's taking in this particular endeavor that we're involved in. I must say that it takes someone in a position like the one that he has with a passion for doing this job and doing it right,
from before the legislature can be effective, perhaps as I will on our mission. I also would like to thank my two distinguished senators who have spent so much time on this issue in their careers here that I've been familiar with. And the Mr. Britton's report and the DOJ report and what you've done, and I think what Senator Carter was kind of talking about, I'd like to see a flow sheet here.
Right.
That goes along and indicates where you think you've solved this problem. Where you think you've got a possibility that this is going to be a solution. It's an operation in there right now. And where there are areas where we haven't touched the surface yet, you know, and anything that's going on in between there. So as we proceed through the weeks that we will be meeting dealing with this, we'll be able to follow a flow sheet and we'll be able to look at it as we get further down the road. And I think that will help all of us, because I share Senator Courtney's, and this is painful for me, concern about, you know, where do I trust you? And we've had a lot of discussions in the associations over the last couple of years, and you're people that I, you know, admire and respect. But when I read stuff like this, I've got to ask myself, is there something wrong with your evaluation of people? We need to get to the bottom of it. And I think it would help if you could do that and provide us a flow sheet on this as we go down the road with it.
Thank you, Representative. Have some from there, please.
Thank you, Mr. President, I have a series of questions, and I've been writing some of them down. We don't have time. I'm wondering if it would be appropriate for us to direct these questions to these gentlemen and maybe a copy to you and Representative Rosenbaum, or maybe even the whole committee, that we can have answered it, because this is just the first of many meetings, I'm assuming.
Senator Carter, Jason Davey, and I will come back in 2 weeks. By all means, I want your questions answered. You need to wait until then. You can give a heads up. Whatever you want to do, Representative.
Okay, and I've got to leave in just a few minutes. If we could come up with another time that we would be meeting, that would be helpful.
I'll get that to answer.
Thank you.
Representative Clem, please, and Representative Berger, which is
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, on an ongoing basis, two of the things I'm going to be interested in are the progress of community placements vis-a-vis the master plan, the phase two recommendation. Because that said that over time, our population at these facilities is going to be 2,000, not 900, as we're planning for building in Junction City and here. All of that is supposed to take place in the community. And yet we dedicated, I think, $9 million towards that this last session and $500 million just to rebuilding these. And I see we have challenges getting these things out there. So are we really building enough beds here in our plans? Are we going to be able to get those other 1,000 human beings through the growth of Oregon? And some percentage are going to end up here. And I'm really concerned about that. I have been for some time, and I'm still concerned that are the facilities we're building going to even be enough? Because half the population is not even going to be here. And this report covers just the ones that are here. And the other thing I think is trying to just understand specific things. If you do a flow sheet that talks about a fix that has been made, I'm trying to understand, just from one story, a gentleman who he gained 11 pounds from basically gulping water one day, the next day another 14 pounds, the next day another 12 pounds. Somebody was weighing him. So somebody knew that he was gaining that kind of weight. Is it just pure overstaffing that person then got called off to somewhere else? And so they weighed him, saw he gained 12 pounds, said he was on a 1-to-1 ratio. I don't want an answer to that question. But when you read an incident like that, is that just overstaffing? Is that, what is the larger cause of that particular horror story, I guess, so we're not just trying to solve that one horror story, but, you know, what is the greater issue involved, you know, that would cause somebody to be able to be on one-to-one ratios and not notice? Well, we noticed they were getting away. We just weren't able to stop it somehow.
Representative, please.
Thank you, Mr. President Courtney. I'll be very brief in this, but I want to emphasize two things that my colleagues have, both Representative Jensen and Representative Klim, talked about, and this is this notion that, and the reason I bring it up today and now is everybody's here and a lot of attention is being paid today, but it's clear from what I've learned today, and I haven't sat on all these Ways and Means committees, that there's a great danger here of us getting a lot of attention. You come back with reports, and the public walks away saying, oh, they took care of that state hospital problem. It's over. It's now clean. It now has a staffing level that they're happy with, yada, yada, yada. But the fact of the matter is, the huge piece here is the community-based answer. And unless we get the community involved in the dialogue, they won't be part of the solution. So when you come back for recommendations, that means whether we have two new hospitals or not, that's part of the answer. And it is becoming a huge issue in the community. So I guess I'd like to take today to get that fully on the table, because the community needs to be involved here, not just the people in front of you here. And so that needs to be constantly brought up and constantly addressed. Even if we get it clean and we get it staffed, we still are going to need that community-based solutions and how that's going to work, and we need to get the public involved in it.
Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't help but address this hand-washing question. I just wanted to say, because several people have mentioned it, that you may or may not be aware that this hand-washing issue always comes up in every hospital setting, and it's the most common cause, I believe, of hospital-acquired infections in the best of hospitals. If people simply don't wash their hands. So it's not, obviously, we've got egregious problems, but this one is so common, I just felt the need to say that. What I really wanted to say is that we're not going to wash our hands of this problem. I applaud the co-chair, who did not perhaps read from his letter that he had predicted exactly what we're facing right now, that we would be at some point, if we didn't fix this problem, facing the Federal Department of Justice coming in, and even ultimately it would be taken out of our hands. So I think that the reason we hear as much outrage as we do is a lot of frustration and a lot of work over time, as everybody in the audience knows. And I also see people in the audience who have been working on trying to improve these conditions in every way humanly or legally possible. I think the point of this group is that we are committed to two things, as my co-chair said in his press release, which are first describing the problem, and second then laying out what the solution is. Finally, we don't have a choice here. It's not like it's optional for us to just create a nice group that will talk about this. We have to solve this problem or it will be taken out of our hands. So I'm quite confident that we've got the right people on this group, the right people in the room, that we will find a way to deal with this and that we will not be giving up.
Thank you. I understand that you've all been asked at the best times to meet. Is that right, Mr. Corbin?
Mm-hmm.
And next Wednesday at 5:30, someplace in the state capitol, is where we're going to meet next. All right? Next Wednesday at 5:30. But we don't know the hearing room yet because of the dynamics. Yes, Rick.
Can I just add something, too? I'll get out the location real soon. We'll pin it out. And then I did capture most of the issues and questions that you posed that you want to follow up. If members have follow-up questions, send them to me. I'll aggregate them and add them to these and then communicate with DHS so we keep it coordinated.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all the members for the federal legislators for coming here today.
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarification, because there's been some discussion about the hospital and the community services. The planning is not to separate them. I think there's a recognition that community, the infrastructure has to be in place. But right now, we have the immediacy of addressing the state hospital. You know, we started at it looking at the bricks and mortar and some of those other issues. I don't see them, and those of us who are in Ways and Means that have been working with DHS, a separation of those two issues. I just need to say that for those who think somehow we're abandoning efforts of community development in mental health, but I think some of us recognize that you have to have both components if you're going to have a viable and responsive mental health system in the state of Oregon.
Council Logan for being willing to come here today and present.
Did I get that?
John Burton for all the great work he's did. He's done, of course, Dr. Goldberg, Mr. Nicholas, Mr. Hammer, thank you. Thank you very much for the program. Again, my colleagues, thank you. We will meet next Wednesday, as they say, Interstate Capitol at 5:30. I just don't know exactly where. Thank you. Good job.